The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So perhaps I can say a few more words about what I said earlier, talked about earlier. And that has to do with attitude. That almost always we operate under the influence or through the filter of some attitude. And it's easy to let that attitude go unnoticed. And the analogy that I like is that of, I don't know if you had this experience, but you know, you drive around in a car and with clean windshield, and then slowly it gets dirty. The bugs hit it. And it happens so slowly that you don't notice how dirty it's getting. But it's getting dirty enough, you have to kind of strain to see through, but you still don't notice because you're focusing so much on the road and the traffic and driving safely. You don't notice the, you know, what does the glass have to do with driving? Because that's just... And then, lo and behold, you go stop at a gas station and you clean the windshield and you start driving again and you're amazed at how clean it is. The world is clear. Those of you who have glasses have this experience perhaps occasionally, or I've had that. Someone said, "Gil, I'm going to clean your glasses for you." And, oh! And so it's possible to go for a long time with something that interferes with our ability to see clearly because we're so focused on our life, focused on what we're looking at, what we're concerned about, that we don't notice the medium through which we're seeing, through which we're perceiving. And so the attitude can often fit that, it's the medium, can often be the medium, it's the background, it's the filter. And there are all kinds of attitudes. Some of the attitudes are helpful attitudes to have, or fine attitudes, and some attitudes are, you know, are pretty disturbing, or disrupting, or cause obstacles for us. And what's interesting about meditation practice is that sooner or later, at some point in meditation, if your mind gets quiet enough, that even good attitudes need to fall away. Even the things that we think are great and wonderful, you know, positive attitudes. Like even the attitude, I was surprised when I was in Burma with Upandita, one of the things he would teach us is, he probably didn't say it this way, but he said, you know, don't have any compassion. And, you know, he didn't say it that way, but it's kind of like how I heard it. But what he meant was, even the attitude of having compassion was extra in doing deep meditation practice. There might be compassion there. You know, it wasn't like you saying don't have it, but to assume and take on the attitude that any kind of attitude wasn't needed when you get really still. There's another thing that opens up when you become attitude free. And so I say that so that to kind of loosen the hold, the grip that maybe attitudes hold on you, that, oh, it's important to have an approach. It's important to have an underlying intention. It's important to have an attitude, you know. And so some of those attitudes have to do with beliefs. We believe. And so there's always a belief in the background that supports the attitude. Sometimes there's an attitude that's in the background that supports a belief. So which comes first depends on the situation. But just turn around and look into what are the attitudes, what are the beliefs that are in the background that I operate on. And you know, some beliefs that we have are not really articulated, but they're still, nevertheless, they're kind of background beliefs that are kind of influencing everything we do. And you know, one of the surprises that not a few people have when they do a meditation retreat. Meditation retreats are a way of slowly over time highlighting what the basic operating principles are that we're operating under, because we see the repetitive patterns over and over and over again. Whereas in daily life, we get interrupted so much. You know, so much different things goes on, our mind jumps around a lot, or we're distracted from ourselves, and so we don't really notice. But on retreat, You know, after a while, you know, every time your mind wanders off, you're conscious of it. You know where your mind is gone. And you start seeing how repetitive it is. And so it's not an uncommon thing for someone to come to interview with a teacher on a retreat and say, I had no idea how pervasive my fear was. Fear underlies everything that I do and think. And I had no idea. And sometimes people who say this to me, there's no obvious surface indication that this is a fearful person. So, you know, it's not visible from the outside, and it wasn't visible to them until they got quiet enough and actually saw what was going on in the background. So there could be, you know, so there's a whole series of things could be background attitudes, approaches to things. And what I find interesting, what I have found interesting is that sometimes when I've worked with people very closely with their breathing and meditation, they're really, you know, really getting quiet enough to really track their breathing and see what's going on in their breathing. Sometimes these attitudes get embedded in how we breathe. Is if you know, so for example, it's not uncommon for people who feel like they have to control life and control everything. Everything has to be under control. That's the attitude. And so a place where, in breathing, where we give up control is the end of the out-breath. There's often kind of letting go that goes on there. And so there are people from whom, if they really tune in carefully to the breathing, can feel they're not really willing to breathe out all the way, or that's a place where they wander off into thought or get distracted very easily, because it's a little bit frightening to let go in that breath, because it, you know, it's a place of loss of control, seemingly. And then there have been unknown people for whom they don't want to breathe in. They're fine with breathing out. Let go of everything. Get everything away. But breathing in means it's oppressive. It's like all this input. Things are coming in, you know. Leave me alone, you know. I have to do all this. It's all this work. Breathing in is a work, you know. Life is a work, and I don't want to work. And so there's all these very subtle attitudes that for some people, it's the hitch, the place with the speed bump, has to not with the breathing out, but with the breathing in. Or there are people who are a little bit reluctant to breathe out. I mean, everyone's breathing fine. I mean, but you have to be very, very still to watch what goes on. There's a very, very small little feeling of reluctance to breathe out at the top of the in-breath, because again, it's losing something. It's giving something up, and everything, you have to hoard everything. You have to keep everything close in, including your breath. And so there can be a slight reluctance to just talk about the breathing this way is to point out how subtle the operating of attitude or beliefs or these kinds of ideas can be in our psyche, and how influential it can be in many different ways. It can influence things as subtle as, you know, how you walk. If you're walking through the city, through a town, you know, it could be that there's an attitude. How you sit. When I was at... you know, I spent about 3 years at Tassajara Zen Monastery. And Zen monasteries, everything is kind of, not everything, but a lot of things are choreographed. So like when you sit, how you sit in the meditation is choreographed. You have to sit in a certain way. Sit upright, you know. Straight back, and hands in a particular position, head in a particular position. And when you stand up, you have to stand in a particular way and hold your hands a certain way. When you step through a door frame, you have to step through a certain way. When you eat, you have to eat in this choreographed way. And all these different situations you go throughout the monastery, you have to bow in a certain way. And so what you do with your body is often choreographed, or, you know, and you have to fit into this. So I did this for about 3 years. And the consequence was, when I left Tassajara, I suddenly became aware that I had a lot more choices. Well, I always had the choices, but I became aware of a lot more choices about things that I'd never considered I had choices about, never occurred to me were interesting or important. So, for example, how I would sit in a chair became a choice. Before I went to monastery, I just sat in chairs. And now I became aware that I had choice, and there were many different ways of sitting in a chair. I could slump, I could sit up straight, I could use the backrest, I could not use the backrest. And I realized that, so I ended up noticing that there's attitudes were also there. I could sit down, and how I sit in the chair is partly influenced by my attitudes, my beliefs, what I'm trying to do. Whereas before I was innocently just sitting in a chair, and this Zen practice interrupted that, interfered with that. It's a little bit of a drag, and I was always, you know, be thinking about, what am I supposed to do? Sitting in a chair is supposed to just be relaxing. But now I have to think about how I'm thinking to sit in a chair, because there's choices. So what's the wise way to sit in a chair? And I remember when I was a college student once being depressed, I was really depressed. And I was sitting on the couch in the home I was in. And at some point I noticed my posture, and I was slumping so deeply into the couch that my shoulders were basically almost down the crease between the barely up against the back of the sofa, you know. So that got my attention. But this is kind of dramatic, I thought. So I thought, let me sit up straight. So I sat up straight, and when I sat up straight, all this energy came, and much of my depression lifted. You know, maybe I wasn't that depressed if it's that easy, right? But what it taught me was the impact that the posture had, and so here my attitude of kind of giving up and this is hard or whatever was going on for me influenced my posture. And the posture then probably had a feedback loop that influenced how I felt. And so sometimes it's a spiral, we spiral out. So what is your attitude? What is your background mood? What is the, some of the background operating principles that might be there all the time that maybe you haven't been so conscious of that are always there? When you open a door to go into a new place, a new room, a store, a new place you haven't been, is there a common pattern in the attitude with which you step in through that door, the concerns you have, the worries you have, what you're trying to do when you go in? Would you just walk into a new space without any thought about it at all, just like, you know? Or are you just kind of completely random, whatever you might be concerned or attitude is? Or are there a common pattern in what you do when you come into a new place? Or if you... answer an email. If you have if you write an email, is there a common attitude that you have about it? I have attitudes. One attitude I have is I like getting the mail here at IMC. I'm the one who gets the mail here. And I don't know what it is about picking up mail. It's comforting for me. I find it pleasant. So I actually like doing it. That's a small little, one of my small little pleasures. I go open it up and see what's there. There's seldom anything for me, but that doesn't matter. I don't care. It's just, I don't care, but it's just something nice about it. So that's an attitude I have, so I just go along with it when it's easy. And then sometimes I see I have an attitude about emails. Oh, no. So it's very important to track this, to be aware of this, because if I don't track all this stuff and don't take some responsibility for it, then some of them can get in trouble. So for those of you who might have an attitude, I'd encourage you to be more mindful of it. So thank you.